AshevilleFM.org, soon to be 103.3 WSFM LP in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Burst of Goodness. The show can also be heard on KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KXCF in Marshall, California, KOWALP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRSLP in Columbus, Ohio, stomping ground of Wildman J. Wild Kasich. This week we'll be featuring the second half of a presentation by Mel Basil, an indigenous Gixxon and Wet'suwet'en organizer, sovereigntist, and anarchist of the Unist'ot'en Action Camp. For folks in the listening audience, Unist'ot'en is located on unceded native lands in so-called British Columbia, Canada. More about the camp can be found at Unist'ot'en, that's U-N-I-S-T-O-T-E-N, camp.com. This audio is from an almost hour and a half long presentation that Mel gave on Saturday, the 24th of May, at the Montreal Anarchist Book Fair, entitled, quote, Anarchy, Indigenous Sovereignty, and Decolonization, unquote. Many thanks to CKUT Radio in Montreal for sharing this content with The Final Straw. More info on CKUT can be found at www.ckut.ca. In this episode, Mel talks about human rights versus responsibilities to ourselves and our relationships with the surroundings. He talks about the Unist'ot'en camp's invitation to anarchists to come and struggle against the government and corporate incursions in the form of tar sands, pipelines, and the upcoming injunction, which is expected to come down today, June 15, 2014. Mel discusses solidarity with communities resisting and suffering the extraction and transport of fuels such as tar sands and fracked natural gases, and those suffering from the effects of homogenic climate change, and more. But first, we have a special commentator whose voice you all might recognize. Here's Sean Swain! What you say, what you say, what you say,
what? Come like a bomb! Have you heard about the case of adjunct professor James Kilgore at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign? Kilgore is an interesting guy. In the early 1970s, he was a member of the Symbionese Liberation Army, which makes him a personal hero of mine. The SLA was an urban guerrilla faction, robbed banks, kidnapped Patty Hearst, and, along with the Weather Underground, effectively brought an end to the Vietnam War. As one demand for the release of Patty Hearst, the SLA had Hearst's father, the publishing magnate, deliver millions of dollars in free food to the inner city poor of Oakland. There's a PBS documentary called Guerrilla about the SLA. It's inspiring. Starting in 1975, Kilgore went underground and lived overseas until 2002. He then came back to the U.S. and pled guilty to possession of explosives, a charge from 1975, and to passport fraud. He served 6 years in prison, and since 2010, Kilgore has been on the faculty of the University of Illinois in Urbana, teaching classes on urban planning and on global studies. After Kilgore effectively organized his community against the building of a new jail in town, a local rag called the News Gazette went on a smear campaign against Kilgore. The paper published a few pieces on him that completely reinvented the facts of Kilgore's SLA involvement. They completely sensationalized the story, with the clear goal of getting Kilgore ousted from his job. Keep in mind, when the University of Illinois hired Kilgore, they knew about his past. He didn't lie about it or try to conceal it. He came into the job interview as a former urban guerrilla with a felony conviction and was still the best teacher for the job. But under pressure from right-wing headhunters at the local Poison Pen, Kilgore was fired. Since then, a petition has circulated and gained the needed 1,000 signatures in support of James Kilgore. He's gained statements of support from Associate Provost Robin Kaler and from American Association of University Professors. There's also been a groundswell of support from prisoner rights groups who see the implications of this case for the employment of convicted felons everywhere, 15 million Americans. Personally, I take a different view. I don't believe James Kilgore should fight to make the University of Illinois rehire him. To me, that's pointless. The spineless, hapless university administrators have already proven that they're slaves to perceived public opinion when they fired Kilgore. Well, let him go. Under the pressure from the News Gazette. So if Kilgore gets rehired under public pressure, he has to worry for the rest of his life about idiots who managed to mount a counter-campaign of successful pressure again. Kilgore could be hired and fired a dozen times before he retires. Who needs that kind of stress? I think that rather than going back to the university on bended knee with his head in his hands, Kilgore should do what he does best. He can organize dozens of former students with whom he developed his best rapport and recruit them for a new project. If the powers that be want to foreclose on Kilgore's efforts to put down the assault rifle and turn over a new leaf and make a new start, perhaps he should pick up the assault rifle and lock and load. He could easily reconstitute the Symbionese Liberation Army, teach former students the strategies and tactics of guerrilla warfare, and start the next campaign with an assault on the nuclear gun. Then he could storm the University of Illinois in Atlanta, fighting a ski mask, the staccato rhythms of a machine gun to punctuate his arrival. My thinking is, if the gatekeepers of modern culture want to pee on someone trying to go along with the program, they should perhaps have enough sense not to pee on the guy who can assemble an AK-47 in 30 seconds and shoot your face off. Forcing them to deal with a newly constituted urban guerrilla faction, the second incarnation of the Symbionese Liberation Army, would be an excellent way for adjunct professor James Kilgore to teach a valuable lesson. If the system won't accept your peaceful, well-intended participation, use that explosive experience from 1975 and leave a smoking crater where the haters used to be. Shoot first, ask for a job later. This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain from Ohio Supermax Facility. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at Sean Swain number 243-205 OSP 878 Coitsville-Hubbard Road, Youngstown, Ohio 44505. To read some of Sean's writings and learn more about his case, check out seanswain.org.
When I studied anarchy, I didn't go into all of the sectors. I understand that there's anarcho-punk, anarcho-communism, anarcho-social, and I didn't look into those. I can be honest about it. I do have a lot more to learn about anarchy. But what I love is the basic knowledge that nobody else is qualified to live your life for you. And that is the attempt of nation states to control us all. And if we're all breaking free from that colonialism, then that is what we're doing. We're all on the same path of decolonization. But that's the thing. The Gixan can help ourselves decolonize because we understand what our form of colonization is, what hurt us the most, and what we need to get back to. But as a Gixan, I cannot help a person from another part of the world to decolonize. That is your stuff. All it is behaviors that colony taught us, behaviors that attach itself to us, they're habit forming. If we're not living our responsibilities from our origins, then we are living rights-based. And those rights kind of became habits. And the world moved really differently based on rights and capitalism. So if we're axing that and smashing that, and we're localizing, then really what we're learning is new behaviors and new responsibilities. We're just transforming our responsibilities. That is the transformative learning that we're all after, I think. And indigenous models can portray what is closest to the law of the land. And if you can get with the law of the land, that's perfect, because that's all we ask, is that the law of the land is adhered to. So it's not an easy process to consider that things will just be fine and dandy, that anarchist movements and indigenous movements combine efforts. Sovereignty efforts are quite difficult. So I'm really excited to be here. I went to an anarcho-punk show last night, and they provided me a lot of that fire energy we just experienced just a little while ago. I had a lot of fun. I had this silly grin on my face last night while I was moshing, and went upstairs and just watched and relaxed, and I saw the anarchy flag flying the first song, and the Warrior Society flag was hanging down too, and I was so excited. I seen the anarchy flag close to the Warrior Society flag in person. It was not the first time I seen that, but It's the first time I got that energy right firsthand, and I'm really thankful. When I go home, there's a call out to action very soon. This call out to action is because of a nation state injunction that is being produced to stop the Unas-Wilton camp. And we would like to ask the community, the anarchist communities to stay on alert about that and understand that there will be an attempt to push the Unas-Wilton camp out for the very first time. It's about 5 years long running. It's been 20 years in the making. And it's an exciting process because it's not a blockade. People have been getting through. What they do is they come in and participate in a protocol. Anybody wanting to come to the camp goes through a traditional protocol. And the protocol is not it's not like a border patrol where there's violent walls and stern, hateful faces trying to keep you out. It's not that. We are stern, but it's not stern in the form of dehumanization. It's just in the form of, even if I know you and we're good buddies, even if you try to push past me, you're not getting past me. And the protocol is not a violent act, it's more responsibilities-based. So it's dependent upon your knowledge of self. So that's the decolonization piece, is if we can decolonize to have a strong knowledge of self, we're more valuable to each other. And because we live responsibilities-based and it's not rights-based, we're not asking you to come and help us fight for our rights. What we're asking when people come to the camp is, will you help us share in our responsibilities? Meaning, when you come into this territory, it's expected of you to live by the natural law of the people. And when people ask, well, what is that? Well, just watch how the people act. If they're going to approach the river, that's how we expect you to approach the river. If we take an animal, this is how we take the animal, and this is how we respect the entire animal's body parts. And all of these things are all part of our responsibilities, but we need help getting it back because we need numbers. And locally, a lot of our people are involved in mining and forestry and agriculture and don't have the time, or they're also in the social sector. You understand we are under a huge duress, especially socially, with the murder of missing women, children in care, residential school histories, displacement onto lands, the divisions between on-reserve and off-reserve. And so our decolonization pathways are really, really difficult. So we really ask for that understanding. But we wouldn't have been able to do this without all of the mutual aid that we've been receiving. We're so thankful. But we're also thankful that we've also nipped that in the bud to begin with, that we couldn't become the next old boys club, that you wouldn't like us so much. And so we changed it. Instead of asking Canadians to help us with our rights, we're asking anarchist communities to help us share in our responsibilities to protect the land and the waters. And that's been so exciting to see. It's been so exciting to see the changes that all of us are going through, not just ourselves. We're not just asking you to change, we're changing. And it's like we're also helping each other show each other how we can change a little more effectively. But as I mentioned, decolonization is painful. It means letting go of a lot of bullshit from habits. And, I'm sorry, can I swear on the video? Okay. That's what I mean. When we formed this protocol, it was because of a discussion we had years back. We thought about it. This camp needs to be a unique design. It can't just be a straight up blockade. We're not fighting for rights. We can't be getting monies that's also going to control us. So it became responsibilities based, and it was really exciting. So what we thought about was, okay, that is not the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. We flipped the script on rights. That is the United Native Nations Declaration of Responsibilities of Indigenous Peoples. And that's because we thought about that before. We don't have rights, we have responsibilities. We don't have a right to clean water, we have a responsibility to our relationship to clean water. We have a responsibility for our own safety. And we have a responsibility to each other. And so that really changed how we do a lot of work. So this protocol, it was born out of traditional stories. And if you come from Native nations here in the local region, your traditional trickster stories probably also has some warriors or guards outside your village, guarding the village, not just from enemy attack, but also from your tricksters. Because the tricksters is us. Our warriors are meant to defend the land from ourselves. That's the self-regulation of our law. So the protocol is designed to have really, really strong trade relations with our neighbors, because it was a risk if we came in, we didn't know ourselves, we didn't really know what we were doing with the berries or the fish, and here we are trying to trade. And that's a risk. If we go to our neighboring nations with stuff that we didn't really know how to do, then they didn't want to trade with us. They didn't even want to let us in the land if we didn't know who we were. So knowledge of self was the real huge key. And I paddle a war canoe, and we've paddled to other communities before. And when you paddle a big war canoe into a community, you have to stop at the beach, and you have to wait for the hosts to come and welcome you. But they don't just welcome you and you just land and just come in. A war canoe is exactly that. It's a war canoe. And if you're paddling to a community, it's expected to display who you are. So the bow person, whether man or woman at the front of the canoe, at the bow, has to hold up their paddle. And that paddle has their crest, their design, probably tattooed on the person too. But the crest of the clan is carved onto the paddle. The other side of the paddle is plain. And if you come to the community and you're showing the plain side of the paddle, you're declaring war. If it's got the crest facing the community, you're here for peace and trade. But that crest isn't the only form of identity. Anybody could have a paddle with a crest on it. It was the person that knew themselves that showed that they could portray their nobility with a lot of respect, and they're givers. They're showing their skills to the next generations. They earn the ability to wear a crest. Not everybody just wears a crest. It's people who have noble names that were shown that nobility over time. They were the ones that wore these crests. So you're declaring war, or you're here for peace. If you're declaring war, you're not really going to ask permission. You're just going to land your canoe forward and just hop out, and your paddle's your weapon. So you're here for attack. But if it's got the crest forward and you're waiting, and the matriarchs and the chiefs come to the beach to welcome, they ask the protocol to be conducted. Introduce yourselves. Who are you? Where you come from? What clan are you? I don't believe you. Show us your dance. Then you had to pull out some planks on your canoes and do a dance. You had to sing your song and perform your dance. And if the host nation recognizes your dance because they've seen it before, then they may allow you in. But you have to now introduce everybody in your canoe. And if there's items in that canoe that were sent, but the people aren't there, they still have to be introduced, even if they're not in the canoe. So we designed this protocol at the bridge much like that. If an NGO sent you there, introduce them too. If a community fundraised to get you there, introduce that. That was what it expected. And the protocol is not a rights-based system. It's you don't need to pull out ID and prove who you are. We just want to see that you do have a strong knowledge of self. So a lot of people talk about the skills that they're proud of, what form of anarchist or grassroots community that they come from. And it was also based on story, as I mentioned, trickster legends. In some of our trickster legends, the warriors were depicted stopping the trickster from coming in, asking, "Who are you? What is your business here?" How long do you plan to stay? And that was at a proximity. Because when we learned about warriorism, we understood even though if we had a language barrier, all of our roots, your warriors from your history, would have understood ours. Ours would have understood yours. Just based on stature, proximity, we would have understood if we came any closer, it would have been a fight. Nobody wakes up in a day and just wants a fight. Sometimes I do. But nobody wants that every day. So warriors aren't running around looking for fights. They're busy. They're busy getting a strong body, strong mind, and a strong connection with their community by working with them, working beside them, showing those responsibilities. So our warriors would have all understood each other in the past. There would have been protocol between us too. So it's not new. The United Nations did not design the pathways that Indigenous people really need. In fact, I know that the rapporteur took a lot of effective information from many Indigenous communities, and I'm pretty proud to see that. But what I'm not proud of is that they termed it rights, and it is still a hierarchical system. Have you heard of papal bulls? Doctrines of discovery? 1300s and 1400s, papal bulls were written by popes to uphold monarchies and nation-states. League of Nations formed their language around papal bulls, and the League of Nations became the United Nations. So international law has its roots in racist ideologies from these papal bulls. They're written by Catholic popes to uphold kings and queens and nation-states. So that's why there's military and police uphold this crest that looks at mystical beings that uphold natural law in the form of really the empire building based on bastardized forms of spirituality. I say bastardized because the Bible is written up from oral histories from Middle Eastern peoples. The oral histories are important for the people who originated them. Our oral histories are important to us. Nobody's oral history, nobody's responsibilities are more or less important than each other's. I don't contend with that form of spirituality. I'm just saying it's not any of ours, unless you're from that original peoples that has that story. But it got translated into many of these different languages into the form of Bible that people see. And that's what nation states are formed from, is this bastardized form of a spirituality that's really important to some people, but not to the whole world. We all have our own origins and our own spiritualities, our own tribalism. Empires switched all that up, turned it into something completely different. It's confused us all. I don't know if it's a lot to ask to see that our communities can come together in this way. It is challenging. I think I can say we would have had way more challenges if we opened up the camp to all communities, not just anarchist communities. I think our challenges would have been much, much greater. But we did have great challenges with anarchist communities and our community coming together, because there's still that attempt to fit, and it won't be a full fit. I think we have a lot of expectations on it, and maybe this is some of the first few times that this is happening within different communities. What we expect of ourselves is, you know, we don't always fulfill our own expectations of ourselves. So seeing communities come together and the expectations based on that, we're gonna have some disappointments. So we have to get past that. And we did. So it's really exciting right now. At the moment, there's a build-up camp. They're finishing a bunkhouse, a pit house, and a permaculture garden, and more structures, but also the onset of a potential injunction being delivered by the police and by the BC government. Just yesterday, there was a big action by Rising Tide in Vancouver, and the day before that, too, they unfurled a massive banner, BC, LNG, invest at your own risk. And this was a big, big AGM for LNG. It was a massive LNG conference in Vancouver. So this is really exciting to see all the solidarity being extended towards the Unist'ot'en camp, but we also understand that we cannot be the only unique camp like this. We would like to encourage other communities to have the same model of anarchist support, grassroots support, mutual aid between local movements here. Energy East is very similar in the sense that it looks to help expand tar sands and transport dirty bitumen to the coast this way. Well, there's six of these pipelines presented from the tar sands toward the coast through our direction. And so we do ask for that solidarity, but we understand that there's also this fight. So I'd like to create some awareness around carbon offsetting. Carbon offsetting is a false solution. I'll just be really quick about this. Carbon offsets, there's still emissions of carbon, even if there's carbon offsets. You're still emitting carbon. All it is distracting communities from each other, fragmenting solidarity. I got a stuffed up nose, so I'm starting to transform my recording. The Energy East pipeline, knowing that it's much like the Kinder Morgan, existing Kinder Morgan pipeline, that is an old LNG pipeline. And you understand that tar sands bitumen is compressed, heated, mixed with condensate so that it will flow. It's highly pressurized, it's heated, superheated, and the pipeline itself is heated to keep it hot so that it will flow. If you haven't seen any images of tar sands before, it's a solid rock. They're mining it. It's not like drilling for oil like the Clampets from Beverly Hillbillies. You know when he missed that rabbit and shot oil? Yeah. It's not like that. They're strip mining the size of Florida. That's how much earth is gone from this space. And they want to triple it. These companies want to triple that effort up to as far as Tuktoyaktuk. They want to go to Madagascar, Trinidad, Tobago, Peru's rainforest, Siberia, Africa. They want to go all these places. And Romania. So there's interests not only in Canada continuing to expand tar sands, but also to show the rest of the planet how to do it. And that means certain danger for the whole planet if that's the case.
We'll be right back to this presentation by Mel Basil, an Indigenous Gixan and Wet'suwet'en organizer, sovereigntist, and anarchist of the Unist'ot'en Action Camp. Presentation was entitled Anarchy, Indigenous Sovereignty, and Decolonization from the 2014 Montreal Anarchist Book Fair.
Corporations dancing on the ruins of multinational corporations. Ha, 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 ha. Say goodbye to plastic and goodbye to cars. No more convenience stores. Hello to stars. No more Wall Street and no more Pentagon. Thinking about these things makes me happy. Multinational corporations dancing on the ruins of multinational corporations. Ha, 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 ha. Goodbye to polystyrene, we'll put it into the waste. There is no time for debating, we have to make haste. If we're going to survive without computer program lines, we're going to have to can pop culture. Multinational corporations, ha, 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 ha. Sayonara to suburbia and well-manicured lawns. Bye-bye Barbie and Ken doll bonds. No more developers or slime ball execs. Your condos are on fire. Right. skyscrapers cut down. Yes, we are coming for your children. Oh, we're dancing on the ruins of multinational corporations. Dancing on the ruins of multinational corporations. Dancing on the ruins of multinational corporations. Ha, ha, ha.
Back with Mel Basil, an indigenous Gixxon and Wet'suwet'en organizer, sovereigntist, and anarchist of the Unistoten Action Camp. The presentation was entitled, quote, Anarchy, Indigenous Sovereignty, and Decolonization, and it was presented at the 2014 Montreal Anarchist Book Fair. In this following segment, Mel talks about resistance to the government's pushing through of tar sands extraction and bitumen transportation via pipelines. This resistance was held by Indigenous people with anarchist allies in so-called Canada and continues. He also talks about comparisons of Plan du Nord by the Quebecois government to Pacific Gateway, the plan being pushed through by the BC government to extend and increase the economic development of those provinces by rapid extraction and exportation of resources. Finally, alongside answering questions, Mel revisits the concept of prior and informed consent protocols. More on that and other related topics can be found at unistotencamp.com. That's UNISTOTENCAMP.com.
So this is the education piece that we're asking people, because these carbons are 80% higher in carbon than other greenhouse gases. Fractured gas is the same. It's higher in carbon than greenhouse gases, methane. And so knowing that these companies want to expand because of these pipelines, would assist them in expanding. That's the solidarity that we ask for, is to understand about the false solutions behind carbon offsets. Carbon offsets says, why don't you protect your land and make money too? Holy shit, what a dream come true. I would go for that if that was the message, but I'm a critical thinker. Well, why? Why does that work? Why does it work? No, that's the false solution. I'm not going to go with that. The carbon is still getting emitted. It's just distracting people from where it's being emitted from. And it's not meant for real sustainability. I don't think these companies really care if carbon offsetting succeeds. They only want it in place to help them expand and access lands. Have you heard that the President Obama wants to pass the Keystone XL if it is mitigated? The construction phase, he wants it mitigated. He doesn't want it just willy-nilly. That means carbon offsets, biological offsets, and boreal offsets. So my theory is that these pipeline companies chose such a beautiful spot to destroy so that it will be a given that there's opposition, strong opposition. And Patrick Daniels in 2009 stated that if there is strong opposition to the Northern Gateway Pipeline, we will back off. And how much stronger does opposition need to get? This is the strongest opposition that any corporation has ever seen. And Enbridge is really actually a red herring. Much cumulative impact actually expanded underneath many of our people's noses because everybody was focused on Enbridge. They had their blinders up. They had these Enbridge blinders up, and mining expanded, agriculture expanded, forestry expanded. And here I theorize that these pipeline companies actually plan to back off after they acquire tenure, and they're going to acquire tenure with Stephen Harper's rubber stamp. But it's illegitimate tenure, because Canada's Confederacy is incomplete. It's incomplete because of the genocide presented to our peoples from smallpox, from Hudson Bay Company, and from James Douglas, and from Joseph Trutch. And Joseph Trutch, in the 1860s, claimed authority to extinguish our Aboriginal rights and title without adhering to the Royal Proclamation of 1763, their own laws they broke to form a nation state. So this illegitimate country is attempting to force legitimate peoples off their lands. So how that affects Energy East? If we're educating our own people against offsets, we're making it less likely that these companies here can buy offsets to mitigate their pipelines, mitigate the tar sands expansion, mitigate mining, and not just here, but in other countries as well, Guatemala, Ecuador, Papua New Guinea, Nigeria, selling offsets to Canadian companies that are elsewhere, abroad, making it easier for them to infiltrate responsibilities of indigenous peoples elsewhere else. So we couldn't get with that. We could not fragment our solidarity to other peoples. We had to emphasize our solidarity. So that was why we got strong education from folks like Drew and McDonald about carbon offsetting and their false solutions, but also Rising Tide put out some really wonderful work about the false solutions behind carbon markets. Luckily at that time, yeah, we did that. And the Wet'suwet'en territory is massive, and the pipeline corridors, one quarter of it is Wet'suwet'en territory. So if we effectively shut down carbon offsets in our territory, that is how much land mass they do not get to use to mitigate the Keystone XL. I think that is why they only allowed the southern route to be complete. I think they're waiting for more carbon offsets to finish the rest of their Keystone XL, and we're shutting them down. We're a stronghold. We're not going to allow carbon offsetting in our territory, and we're educating more communities against it in solidarity with folks fighting Energy East, Keystone XL, tar sands expansion, mining expansion worldwide. So be critical about what looks like might fragment your solidarity from other nations, other peoples. Let's just do some questions then, because I feel like I ran out of things to talk about here. Yes?
Are you suggesting that people go to the camp sometime soon? Like, you mentioned that, like, they're saying they're going to set the injunction afterwards. Is there any kind of message from the sort of
check their website, but the message we hear is, yes, please, if you're willing to stand up, if you can or cannot move to the camp, if you can, there is a caravan leaving Toronto. Check out Toronto, I think it's the Environmental Justice Circles there. They've produced a bus to caravan a number of people there. I don't think I can get all of you in this room there, but whoever can come throw down. Do it safely, have an understanding with the camp. They also ask that you go through the Victoria Forest Action Network to kind of register your name, and just so that we know numbers. People have used aliases, so that's cool. But when you go through the protocol, you have to pass the protocol. So it's a, if you don't know yourself here and you're coming to present yourself, and if you don't pass protocol, it's not personal. People have not passed protocol, police and government mostly, so I think a lot of you are safe unless you're a cop, you're going to fail protocol. When they also called out to action, if you can't come, if you can present some solidarity actions from here, if there's a Chevron company or an Apache company this way, yeah, take strong action against them. I love the Black Bloc tactic, I love diversity of tactics, I support it. A lot of people back home kind of argue with me about this, and I tell them, well, how is it different? If we dismantle a machine on the land to stop a destruction, how is that different from the Black Bloc tactic being deployed in a city where their destructive practices are represented from their storefronts? I support the diversity of tactics, and I'm thankful for them. When I saw that heart attack in 2010 in Vancouver against the Hudson's Bay Company, my heart and myself were beaming and smiling. I wanted to be there. My buddies were there, and I was just like, yes. Because of the guilt and the blood on their hands, and I understand the Black Bloc tactic and its origins and forming unions and supporting unions being formed and being on the front line against the police, keeping the activists safe. I don't contend with NVDAs either. I love nonviolent direct actions too, as part of diversity of tactics. That's why I'm so proud to meet more and more anarchist communities and learn more. Again, I'm not perfect. I'm not pretending to be an expert on indigeneity or anarchy. I've just been watching and paying attention to what I can, and this is what I have. And I love the marriage between the two communities. I'm hoping that we can show collectively the rest of settler society how we can do things different If we're promoting transformative change within our communities, why don't we put that outward and find ways to get that outward to more communities that don't know, that are either ignorant or complacent to these issues, or part of the problem, the culprits themselves. I understand also the spectrum of allies, and I see anarchist communities as active supports to our movement. And we hope to be in your spectrum of allies and the active supports to your movements too. We want to also promote a lot of solidarity. It's difficult because we're kind of secluded to what we're doing, but this is part of it, coming to the book fairs and understanding anarchist communities better, because I don't want to pretend to know you. So who's your leader? Your leader to talk to me. I'm really thankful for this time. If you have a few more comments or questions, we do have some time, so spit them out. This is the time.
Looking at things as responsibilities as opposed to rights that are really conflicted with anyone just you want to work with?
There are some good boardroom tables for the time being. Elections for chiefs. It's not guaranteed you're going to elect a chief in the boardroom table who is going to be as honorable as the last one. So when we speak out against rights, some communities do need basic human rights, like right now. That's why I'm saying I don't contend fully with people who are seeking rights. There are communities in this world that do need basic human rights, like right now. They need to be granted. But after they are granted, we also ask that communities provide more support, not just limited support, because rights are limiting, right? Right? Rights are limiting. Responsibilities are limitless. You can assure quality of everything you have in your life if it's responsibility-based. But if it's rights-based, it's going to be a diminished form of your needs. Housing, food, clothing, shelter, safety, all diminished forms of rights. Water. Fort Nelson is heavily extracting fracked gas. Their right to clean water is diminished, so they have to bring it in by tanker. Every household has a cistern, and a tanker of fresh drinking water is delivered to everybody in that community. There's only a few hundred people in that community. They're very wealthy, but they don't have the wealth of water. Their relationship to water is destroyed. Kuwait has no fresh water. It's all destroyed. They desalinate ocean water at a rate that is not sustaining their needs. They're thirsty, their plants are thirsty, their industry is taking it all. The industry is not thirsty. All the rest of their needs is from the ocean waters. Baku, Azerbaijan, I saw the images of the wasteland is left there. These companies are not cleaning up their mess. They're not cleaning up the water. The Kalamazoo, when that spill happened, there was no cleanup. There was just rolled out grasses to make it look like they finished cleaning up. You step on the grass, oil sops up. They got caught. They got fined. I don't think they got fined enough. We need to stop Energy East. We need to stop Clipper from being expanded. We need to stop the Keystone XL. Choke the death into the tar sands and the fracking. But that also means transitioning to so-called alternative energies. They're not alternative energies yet because we did not turf oil and gas, fossil fuels. They're additional energies. And we cannot have the same expectations on alternative energies as we do on oil and gas. Oil and gas sustains a lot of waste development. A lot of waste. There's so much components moving this way and that, that they expend a lot of energy before it gets to your plate or it gets to your system. Oil and gas has subsidized human population's growth, but also the growth of waste. So we cannot have those same expectations on solar, and on microhydro and on wind. So I don't support massive, massive wind farms to mirror oil and gas. That cannot be the attempt. We can effectively continue to destroy this planet even with alternative energies. So that's, I don't know if that answers the question about responsibilities. We need to do things much more responsibly. And that means controlling that waste management to more of a minimum. And that is the indigenous way. And that's what I appreciate about anarchy movements. I love food, not bombs. I love that there's no waste in some communities, but also people are getting fed and educated. to stop war. And I'm so appreciative of being here. I'm gonna cry. No, I'm just kidding. They're warrior tears. And does that answer? I'd like to extend that last question too. So I mentioned solidarity earlier. When we ask for solidarity, we're not just asking for solidarity towards us in the move against stopping the pipelines in our direction. And so June 15th is the date that is expected to see this injunction. It may be earlier, maybe give or take, so please keep an ear open. But if you're making solidarity statements, the solidarity that we carry too is the point of extraction. So think of the people that are suffering from extractives of fracked gas, but also the companies, Chevron and Apache Corporation. Communities that are already impacted by Chevron and Apache, where it's proposed impact on us. We're still in a good picture here, but there are people who are suffering because of Chevron and Apache, and we really think of them. Think of people in Ecuador, Nigeria, Papua New Guinea, Australia, Mapuches. There are territories, traditional territories, that are currently impacted by Apache. There was a big fracked waste spill in Edmonton and Alberta. So think of those communities as well, please. It's not just solidarity to the Unistaten. We're really thinking of the people who are already suffering because of these companies. That's why we're strongly stopping these companies. So we're not asking just for attention to the camp. We'd like to put attention to also the point of consumption, that fracked gas is 80% higher in greenhouse gases, methane and carbon and other greenhouse gases, and how that affects indigenous peoples on the islands and island states who are losing shoreline and food sources, meaning they have to transport by oil and gas vessels to transport foods to them. That we're also thinking of those children and those future generations. And we're also looking at stopping climate change, and we need to be much more mindful of point of consumption as well, not just extraction. We're taken strongly at the point of assumption that these nation states assume that there's just a free-for-all here. There's no free-for-all. We're a wall, we're not a hurdle. They assume that we're a hurdle to get over. We're a wall and they're not getting past us. But in solidarity with those communities that are already suffering from these companies, Enbridge, Apache, Chevron, Spectra Energy, TransCanada. You've heard of that explosion in Manitoba from TransCanada's pipeline? That's methane migration. They thought the pipeline was empty, but there was still some spark in there, and boom. Burns Lake had a compression station explode, and that was a small compression station. That was in the 80s. People thought nuclear war was happening. All the houses were shaking. There was a big boom. There was a huge ball of fire. These compression stations now are like five times the size of the ones that we see already, because these are massive pipelines. The Pacific Trails pipeline was originally 32 inches in diameter in its proposal. It expanded to 42 and now 48. So 48 inches in diameter, bidirectional. So they wanted to import and export LNG, LFG, liquefied frack gas. So those solidarity statements that we're asking for, if you can't go to the West Coast, find an office or a space to take it strongly to these corporations here and speak on behalf or learn about people who are taking action against Chevron. I believe in September, there's a group from Vancouver forming what they call the Chevron Action Coalition. And they're going to be touring so that communities who are impacted by Chevron will be touring. So please support them too. And take it strongly to that Energy East. I'm really proud of the resistance here against Energy East and fracking in this direction. Last thing I would like to say too is Plan du Nord. Plan du Nord is much like BC's economic plan. They call it Pacific Gateway. A lot of highway expansion, railway expansion, communications expansion, port expansion, terminals, bulk terminals, oil and gas terminals, tankers, pipelines, mining, forestry, agriculture, all expansion. Plan du Nord looks to employ thousands and thousands of people. And the Canadian pension plan invests heavily into the tar sands and expansion of military. So if this community successfully employs that many people, that's how much more investments get into the military and tar sands. So there's a bill passed federally that divestments in CPP is impossible. They cannot divest from. So we can't allow them to expand it because they're not going to start taking it away. If they keep investing, what they should do is invest in cleanup, because we're going to shut it down, right? Because all they're going to have is money to clean up now. So that's what I would like to conclude this. I have so much more to talk about, but this is our time. Any more quick questions? We have, what, 5 more minutes? Knowledge of self leads to decolonization because the colony attempted to define who you are through controls, indoctrination from schools, from church fears, from policing, controlling you and compacting you and fitting you into this socialized box. And I don't always say you should think outside the box. I don't support that. Decolonize the box, because we should fit in something. And that decolonized box can be expanded and limitless, but we should still fit within something. Decolonize that box. Also, solidarity to all forms of justice is another piece. Knowledge of self is, you come from different movements, the LGBTQ movement, the environmental justice movement, climate justice, people of color. Knowledge of self, all of your different groups and affinity groups would have different definitions of how you do things. And that's important to us to know. I don't know people's pronouns. I don't know if you should be they or she or he. I don't know those things. I'm still learning, and I really respect it. We really believe that justice should be presented to everybody, not just a few. And I don't support movements if they start denying access to justice to other groups, just so that they can emphasize theirs. And so that solidarity is really important, and knowledge of self is a huge piece to that. But like having that paddle with the crest on it, I would be at risk coming to another community if I didn't know myself well enough, and I just had kind of shoddy work. You need to protect yourselves from my ideologies if I don't know myself. That's where decolonization can occur. You're not just denying colonial state, you're getting to know who you really are. And that's skill-based, that's based on your roots from your origin. And if you don't know those things, then look back. One person asked me, well, I come from an oppressive state. No, you don't. That is not your origin. None of us are originated from oppression. We all come from a beautiful origin. We all do. That is what we're asking to get back to. That's the knowledge of self that I'm not talking about. So that is what's helpful to other communities. And I don't know if I can say much more about that. Any more time or any more questions? 4 minutes? 4 minutes, guys. Anybody got any jokes? Cop jokes? I want a cop joke.
How many cops does it take to tile a roof?
How many?
It depends on how thin you slice them.
Okay. What a good way to end it. Who's responsible for that roof? All I can end with then is more encouragement. Get to know each other. If you don't know each other, introduce yourself. Don't be shy. We're all in this together. We're really responsible in this generation to stop this bitch now. My daughter and my son understand what I'm doing. They know I'm here for a duration, and they know why. So that cultural resistance is also there. We didn't learn that from anarchy, and anarchy didn't learn it from indigenous movements. I think it's just viscerally, we all kind of built up our cultural resistance. So I think what we're asking is, how do we blend those two together and have a really good fit with anarchy and indigenous sovereignty? That's how I could conclude. Let's get some water and honor it and honor our hosts here. And I'm really thankful to the Mohawk Nation for having me here too. After I'm finished this, I think I get to see a bit of the book fair, but then I'm being brought to some of the local communities. I'd love to promote this pathway of a free, prior, and informed consent protocol. and also to other movements. This is really applicable to all of your work, especially protecting women and children based around consent. Free prior and informed consent is actually applicable to you too. You should be demanding from men and other women that if you want relationships and intimacy, that it should be free prior and informed consent. It shouldn't cost you anything. You shouldn't be under duress. It should be from the first hand, and it should be fully informed about health, how long, you know, whatever, what commitment level is expected. Fully informed, not half informed, not informed at all. And no, we don't need to teach girls to avoid rape. We need to teach boys consent. And free prior informed consent is expanded into everything we all do: environmental justice, climate justice, reproductive justice. I'm really supportive of all these things. I'm still learning, but I'm not trying to talk from inexperience. I think it's really applicable. So the website is www.unistoten, which is spelled UNISTOTEN.com. And there's blogs on there written up. You'll read up about free prior informed consent. You can read up about responsibilities versus rights. You can read up that anti-mining is anti-pipelines and anti-war. And there's a lot more information you can look at, and links to the Victoria Forest Action Network. We're also very thankful to No One Is Illegal, Council of Canadians, many other affinity groups, not just anarchist communities, that got us to where we're at. And I'm really supportive of Indigenous movements this way and worldwide, that we can maybe follow something like a model like this. And demand respect instead of asking for it. So, thank you. This is Natalia. I'm still getting used to that.
This presentation was by Mel Basil, an Indigenous Gixon and Wet'suwet'en organizer, sovereigntist, and anarchist of the Unistoten Action Camp. The presentation was again entitled Anarchy, Indigenous Sovereignty, and Decolonization, and it was presented at the 2014 Montreal Anarchist Book Fair. Thanks to CKUT Montreal for the audio. That station can be found online at ckut.ca, and more on the struggle Mel and many others are involved in can be found at unistotencamp.com. AshevilleFM.org, soon to be 103.3 WSFM LP in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bursa Goodness. The show can also be heard on KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KXCF in Marshall, California, KOWA LP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRS LP in Columbus, Ohio.